But the only thing is the smell, you know?
Yeah.
When the smell of the bodies. Mm. The guy, the ISIS fighter we saw, they didn't have like smell, but the others, when you go with civil defense, you come back like you cannot eat for 2 or 3 hours because you still like the smell in your brain, but after that, like, I'll be fine again.
Hello and welcome back to Crack Gets Personal, the podcast where we find the most interesting people on earth and ask them the questions you'd be too nervous to ask. My co-host, as always, is Robert Evans, an editor at Cracked.com whose articles have brought the bizarre experiences of people all around the world to an audience of millions. Today, he's brought us the stories of two young Iraqi men with maybe the weirdest college job of all time.
Hey, Brandon. That's right. Today we're going to be talking about two good friends of mine, Sangar Khalil and Iyar Rasool. They're both what are called fixers, people who lead journalists to the front line of a war zone for money. And I met them both during the course of 3 trips I took to Iraq in 2016 and 17 to report on the war against ISIS. And we worked together a lot, so I got to know them in a professional context and did a lot of interviews. But I also got to know them both as friends. You know, we would get hammered together, we went to parties together, drove backwards on the highway together. They're people I still keep in touch with and consider friends. So this is a pretty personal podcast for me, and some of the anecdotes that we relate today are going to come from me rather than a third-party source. You know, and fixing the job these guys have is intensely dangerous. It requires a lot of technical skill and know-how. And it's also, weirdly enough, a job that's done mostly by college kids trying to make extra money on the side. So here's Iyar explaining how he got started.
My name is Iyar Mohammed. I've been doing this for 3 years now. Before the battle with ISIS, I was a sales executive. But I had to quit my job because they attacked all the oil fields and they closed down the oil companies. That's why we lost our business. And basically after 1 week, I was jobless. I'm talking about 2014.
So that's kind of what got him started. There just wasn't any other work. And if you were in your 20s and speak English, suddenly your country's full of people who need someone to lead them around.
That's a crazy job because it sort of created itself. How come they didn't think you were a spy? Like, how do they trust you?
Well, I mean, some of them are. One of the things that helps is most of the fixers who were leading Westerners there are Kurds. Like, Iyar is Kurdish. And so Iraq, there's a northern part that's majority Kurdish, and then there's the southern part that's Arab. And the Kurds are pretty reliable allies of the U.S. They're kind of the one chunk of Iraq that really benefited from that whole war thing because Saddam Hussein kept trying to genocide him, and now he's dead as shit. So they're pretty trustworthy in terms of, like, they benefited a lot from U.S. involvement. And so it's pretty uncommon for them to, any Kurdish people to, like, join groups like ISIS. That just didn't happen a lot.
Do you think that there's any element of organized crime in this job where, like, people vie for different positions so that they can be tour guides?
I never saw any evidence of that. There's not a whole lot of organized crime in Iraq as much as there are militias. And a lot of these guys have affiliations or will be friends with different militias. Like, Iyar is like a pretty normal millennial dude. Like, he lives in an apartment, watches a lot of TV, loves Star Wars and Rick and Morty and shit. But, like, he's also, like, he knows sheikhs. Like, he has all these stories of just, like, meeting with these guys with militias in the desert and, like, they'll just murder a goat in front of everybody and sit around and eat it. And that's like the whole, like, it's a weird life. It's not really criminal because it's like tribal groups, but that's how drugs get moved. And that's how, like, you gotta bribe a lot of people. You gotta, like, grease a lot of fingers, and usually not with cash, usually with stuff like cigarettes or bringing them hookahs or whatnot. Like, it's, so there is a lot of that element, but as a whole, like, Iraq doesn't seem to have a huge organized crime scene because nothing's very organized there. Mm-hmm. Like, you kind of have, there's a level of stability you have to have for there to be like the Russian mafia or something. And if there's not that much stability, then there's not, like, the crime is real disorganized.
How much do you think I'd be worth in terms of cigarettes?
I don't know. I know in Kirkuk, you can get somebody killed for $100.
Awesome. They're,
that's the number everybody shops around. Like, don't go to Kirkuk. I know a guy who will shoot somebody for $100. It's a sketchy little town. But up in the north, it's nice. Like, up in the north, you could probably, it'd probably take thousands of cigarettes to buy you. Anyway, that's maybe on the mean side of things.
No, it's awesome. That's awesome. Everybody's got to know their worth.
One of the things that makes you feel safe working with these guys, and I guess this might work better in a different place than where we're having the conversation now, but, like, I never felt like I would have been in danger with anybody there because there's this big focus on treating your guests right. Wow. Like it's deeper than a religious thing, because it goes back even further than Islam. Like if somebody is your, like up in the Kurdish parts of the country, there are small towns where they don't have any hotels or guest houses, because it would be like a shame on the town if they needed to have a hotel. Because like obviously if somebody comes visiting, like we'll put them up in our houses. Wow. So I never felt like anybody, it would have been like a deeper than a religious offense to have betrayed a guest. So I guess that's kind of important to understand in terms of like why you feel safe working with these people. Like you might get shot by somebody else, but you're not going to get kidnapped as a guest in someone's home, probably.
Awesome.
So I asked IR kind of how he got started, and it was a pretty ad hoc sort of situation. Here's him explaining just how he got his first kind of gig, you know, coming from basically helping people book conference rooms to getting shot at with Vice and the New York Times.
You know why they chose me? Because I was a sales executive and I had good connections with everyone inside the city. So that's why they want me to do work for them, because they need someone inside the city as associate press. So my friend called me, they were like, do you want to translate? I said, okay. And I was actually, I worked as a translator at the beginning. But then they want me to find connections. So I started with my, you know, relatives, cousins, you know, family members. Then eventually I became a fixer.
When he says connections, like anytime you read an article, it's really anywhere in the world, because this job, any country that's undergoing civil strife or warfare or disaster has people doing this kind of job. Like whenever you read like, oh, the New York Times, here's a quote from somebody about some harrowing thing, as likely as not, it's like a friend or a family member of the person that's their fixer, because that's kind of how you're like, oh, I have a cousin who lives in this town that got bombed. The journalist wants to talk to someone who got bombed. I'll send him over to my cousin. That's how a lot of it works. It's a lot of like just having friends everywhere. So you can be like, oh, they want to talk to somebody who saw this execution. Well, I know, you know, my buddy from high school lives in that town, so I'll bring him over there.
Which is crazy, because when all civilization breaks down, you still have gossip and mm-hmm. roaches. And there's always going to be somebody that needs to relay the story. So how do you know that you're getting it from a person who's not biased?
Well, everyone's biased. Like that's the simple matter of it. Is like you're never going to run into anybody who, especially when you're talking about like a war, you're never going to run into anybody who's like, well, you know, ISIS is bad, but like let's be fair to both sides here. You're going to run into people who are like, those motherfuckers shot my brother. But that's why you have to talk to a lot of people. And it's also why, I don't know, it's why reporting on a war zone is kind of difficult. Like, I guess it would have been easier in a situation like Vietnam, where you can see two sides of it. It's kind of hard to see ISIS's side of things. Like, if you work at it for a while, you can kind of get into that headspace, but it's not a very sympathetic cause.
That was my crazy next question was, do you ever deal with the other side in terms of fixers? Have you ever gotten that deep?
I don't know any fixers who support ISIS. I know a few of them who will admit, I know a few people in general in Iraq who will admit if you talk to them long enough that they thought it might be a good thing when ISIS first came. Because like ISIS within Iraq framed themselves as like kind of a fuck the police thing. It's like the cops have been shitty to everybody. We're going to kill them and run them out of town and then we'll run things and it'll be better. And it kind of was for like most people who you talk to who lived under them will say for the first like month or two, it was actually all right. If they're Sunni, they'll say that, because mm-hmm. ISIS is a Sunni group. If they're Shia, they probably got murdered right away, so they won't say much. But most of the fixers that I've had, like, they speak English, so mm-hmm. they're keyed into American pop culture. A lot of them are not religious or outright atheist, but they're very much more citizens of the world, so they kind of can transcend local politics, and that's sort of necessary, because they do have to be able to. Like, one of the tough things is, like, you hear there's been an airstrike and it killed a bunch of civilians. And as a journalist, you want to go report on that. And these guys are like, okay, I'll find you your sources. We'll talk about it. But it's also, like, bad for them because it's their side. It's their government that killed those civilians, or their government who got our government to kill those civilians. And so a lot of times you'll run into them not like, we don't really want to talk about this thing because it's going to be bad for our side in this fight. But we kind of have to, because otherwise that's the job is doing this, which is... I really admire anyone who can, they're the most objective people that I met out there. I can say that, even more so than me a lot of the time. All right. So here's IR talking about like the first time he ever, his first gig was just leading people around refugee camps, which is a pretty safe business, refugee camps. Like nobody has the money to be violent. So here's him talking about kind of the first time he got out to get shot at, basically.
First job, we went to Gaza front line. I think the second day, we got hit by mortar, but it was like 100 meter, 200 meter away from us. But it was crazy, like it was a different experience.
If you've never been hit by a mortar, what it's kind of like is, like, if it doesn't hit you, like you hear all this stuff going awful around you, all this artillery firing for like hours, and then there's just a cloud of dust next to you. And like the fucking, it just covers the sky and you realize that like something explosive has hit right next to you, but you don't hear it until like after it's already hit. Like it happened to me once and it's really burned into my mind. And I think like he just has, he's the only guy I know who has had like an actual Reservoir Dogs experience. Like he showed me this video that he took that's just him in the backseat of his car with a guy who's been hit in the gut with a mortar, bleeding out and trying to like stop it. And it's exactly that scene from like him leaning back into the back seat and trying to like calm this guy down and staunch the blood flow. Like that's what this 24-year-old guy's doing in between working on his business degree.
Yeah, because like, he was a sales account executive,
yeah,
is
exactly,
what he was saying.
Exactly.
That's the craziest night and day.
Yeah. No combat experience or no combat training or anything. Like and so it's just like the war is 2 hours away from his college. So like one day he'll be out there getting shot at and then the next day he'll be like in class. It's like an amazing amount of compartmentalization. Like when you're a journalist working over there, you generally get time on either end of the trip to kind of prepare yourself and decompress. I don't know how they do that, how they like just go on a day-to-day basis from like, all right, today I've got exams and tomorrow we're going to go help dig up some mass graves so that the AP can get pictures of that. It's a weird job, man. And I think one of the things that's important to understand is like how much of our news only gets to us because of people like this. Vice News doesn't have people who live in country and know everything that's going on there, and neither does National Geographic. Like he's worked with Vice News, National Geographic, The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Sunday Times, Foreign Affairs, Wiley News, Associated Press, dozens and dozens of different press organizations. And so his job is 50% making connections with people and like finding folks for them to talk to, and then 50% keeping journalists from getting shot to death in a place where they really shouldn't be.
It's the craziest hotel concierge job anyone on the planet has ever had.
Yeah.
You literally are telling people this is where you can eat and this is where you can sleep and don't go here to get shot and all these other... That's crazy.
That's exactly what it is you're concierging people through a war zone. Like you're doing tours of Stalingrad for people who have never been shot at before and are carrying cameras.
Yeah.
It's your job to stop them from getting themselves killed.
And that's the first people who go in probably are the photographers.
Because
they've got to document it.
Yeah, and it's the photographers who are really, the photographers are focused on getting a good picture. They're not focused on not getting shot at. And so, like, when they're out there, these guys are juggling not getting shot at themselves, making sure the photographer doesn't step on, like, a fucking landmine or run into a bunch of ISIS guys, and then trying to, like, set up the next interview, trying to find people for their journalists to talk to, interpreting and translating. Like, it's one of the most demanding jobs I can imagine somebody having.
You forgot job number 5, which is making sure that the thousands of dollars worth of camera equipment doesn't get jacked.
Well, no, that's not...
Because that, if I was in a war zone and I saw somebody bring in like 10 grand in cameras, I would imagine that that's its own liability. Not that I've ever done that before. Yes.
I imagine that would be a liability in a different place.
Okay.
Iraqis don't really steal. Like, I guess it happens, but it's not... Like, especially in the north, like, people just say, yeah, nobody... Like, it's not something you worry about. And even in Mosul, which is like... destroyed, literally, like parts of it look like the surface of the moon because it's been bombed so much. I never had any worry about being stolen from, and nobody seemed to regard that as a real threat. It's just not something that happens a lot.
Yeah, people should know that.
Yeah.
Nobody hears that ever.
So here's IR kind of describing how he looks at his job, what he breaks apart as like the main functions that he's serving out there.
At the beginning, until the Mosul offensive, I was working for other TV outlets and international media agencies. But I figured out that I don't need to go to front lines anymore because I have now good connections with the Iraqi part and Kurdish part. And I can just use those connections and send people instead of me going there. Because when you're a fixer, you need to know like the stories, what kind of, like you need to find some stories for the journalists if they don't have one in mind. Mm-hmm. And your second duty is to find the connection, find the place, and take them to that place. I mean, I already have connections. I know what kind of stories people are looking for. So that's why I'm just sending translators, drivers. Sometimes we send a security advisor as well if the place is really dangerous. And if the channel or the media outlet, they have a big budget, we sometimes send them with a big team.
So yeah, this guy, he got started, when I first worked with him, he was just him working on his own. And by the time I came back a year later, he had a team of like a dozen or so people who he was just sending out every day with somebody.
Because business school worked.
Yeah, business school really worked. He knows how to hustle.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, after he was smart enough that I was actually with him the last time he ever actually went out to the war zone. After about 3 years of that, he decided to promote himself to management and not get shot at anymore. But like you hear, he speaks real slow. He's got a very deliberate tone. And that's exactly how he sounds when people are shooting at us.
Jesus.
Like he never varies that. Like he's just always... very okay, so we need to get to this place and we need to do this now and we need to like
I hate to break it to you, but I've just been shot in the leg.
Yeah.
We'll probably need to get to a hospital soon just so I can get some tourniquet on this.
We were lucky that never happened out there, but I imagine he would I don't think he would change his tone if he had a gaping leg wound. So, like, he talked a little bit about sending out big teams for the big media outlets. Like, the New York Times doesn't roll out there unless they're with like three big white armored trucks, and they usually have like former special forces guys from the SAS with them, and they roll in very large teams. We ran into a CBS team who was traveling in two giant white armored bulletproof Suburbans, and they all had their body armor on anytime they stepped out, which is silly because it's like 108 degrees out there and most of the army guys aren't wearing body armor in most of the places. But it's one of the things he pointed out is that it's actually really a pain in the ass to work with a team like that, and it's probably more dangerous than just having two or three dudes rolling in a truck.
Yeah, because it's pretty high profile if you come in a white American SUV through the Middle East. People are like, I wonder where these Kansas people just showed up from.
You're looking for somebody to blow up. Like, that's that's going to make the front page.
Yeah, it's like a business suit in the hood.
Yeah.
You're like, you either came here to sell me something or to take somebody away.
Actually, the bigger you are, the easier to target, you know. If you have a big convoy, it's easy to get hit by mortars. I mean, I always try to keep a low profile. You know, sometimes I can bring a SUV and just drive in East Mosul, but I don't do that. I just take a small car. Like an ordinary car, anyone can have it in Mosul. I take it and I just go to Mosul.
We were usually in Kias.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because the guys who are going to shoot at you, they know what you're driving. So basically, even if you'd have come in an armored vehicle, they'd have been like, well, we got RPGs for that today.
Yeah.
They can adjust to whatever you come into town in. So I guess you're taking the risk once you get there, no matter what you're in.
Yeah, but it's also like the times when we almost got blown up by a mortar was the time when we rolled up to a frontline position in a bunch of Humvees. Like we got out of our little white Kia and we got into some Humvees the Army, not the U.S. Army, but the Iraqi Army, like basically loaned us to get up there. And like as soon as we parked and got in the building, they just started dropping mortars like right next to where we'd pulled up. And it was one of those like, oh, yeah, they saw two Humvees with a bunch of white people in them. And if you're ISIS, your big goal is... it's way better to kill a bunch of Americans than anything else, because that's going to get you in the news.
Look, I don't care where you're from. If you see two Humvees and a bunch of white people jump out, that's terrifying. I don't care if that's the middle of New York.
I mean, I just had a microphone, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that is one of like the weird aspects of this is, I guess one thing I learned is that normal cars can take a surprising amount of gunfire. They had a hole from like an AK-47 round right in the front of their car, and it apparently hadn't done any damage. It just went through the hood of the car.
Wow.
But didn't hit anything. I guess they got lucky. But that was always like every time we'd get out, I'd look at that hole and be like, okay.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. But I mean, the fun thing about driving around in the Humvees is that they've all been, like, I don't know how anyone, they're not always running down people in those things because they've all been shot to shit. So like the glass in those things is just like white frosted spider web all across it. And
I also love, does that still work now? Is that still bulletproof? Yeah, it's still bulletproof.
It's probably fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're not great shots.
Right. Well, it's hot.
Yeah. But yeah, Ayar and Sengar, both of the people we're talking to today, were college students the whole time that they were working as fixers. And they actually graduated like a little bit after my third trip. So obviously a big part of their life was juggling their grades and this horrible war. So it's kind of like a Buffy the Vampire situation. Right? They were in college during that, or high school. Yeah,
They were college.
Yeah. So
it's amazing. In America, you can't get a kid to work at Johnny Rockets in the summer. Mm-hmm. If they're trying to pay their own way through college, they still won't do any extra side work. So you look at these cats and you're like, what did you do when you weren't in college? And they're like, I became a fixer and I had a team of people and eventually became my own business and I'm the fourth estate citizen journalist.
Yeah, I mean, fuck Johnny Rockets. People named Johnny are shooting rockets at me.
It's really hard to manage work and education at the same time. So what I'm doing is I'm sacrificing 50% of my education to make some money with fixing and with this company. I used that money to continue my studies, so it's kind of, I cannot do without my education and I cannot do without my business.
So if you're stripping your way through college right now, as much as I have respect for you, you ain't really doing it.
I think, yeah, they would have preferred stripping. It's just better hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. So next I'm going to introduce our other source, Sengar, and he's a lot more outgoing. So Ayar is kind of sensitive, thoughtful. He's the planner. He's the managing type. Sengar is like 80% balls. As soon as Ayar and he started working together, he took over most of the field work because he likes being out there. He likes getting shot at. He likes being up at the front. He likes working with soldiers and stuff. Like he's like a combat pickup artist. Like his job is just going out there and meeting people in the middle of this like terrible, dangerous place and like making friends so that every time he comes by, he has somewhere to stay. Like we would just drive up in this little car and he would get out and start hugging people and then we'd have a place to crash for the night.
He's sort of the Lando Calrissian of it all.
He is very Lando. Yeah, he is the Kurdish Lando. So this clip we're about to play is in reference to a conversation Sengar and I had one morning. We were talking about what to do that day when we were out in the war zone, and we wanted to go follow this disaster response team out to clean up after an airstrike. These are the guys that like pull bodies out after the airstrike. He told me it probably wouldn't be worth doing that day because there was only one body, and that just like wasn't enough to make good footage.
It's only one body. It takes them like maybe, it depends on the rubble, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe it takes them 5 hours, but still it's one. Because I used to be with them like for 20 or more than 28, 9, you know. If it's only one, you don't get good footage. But if it's like more than 10, you know, you'll get good footage because you see lots of guys are involved. Mm-hmm. And different places in the destroyed house. Especially we had 360 camera, you know, if you put it set up in the middle of the rubble, like we could get everything around us. Yeah, but if it's only one body, like in one specific area they work, no, it wasn't good for us.
So one of the things that's weird is this is where we're working is his hometown. This is where he grew up. And he's gotten to the point after 3 years where he's talking about like the bodies of his neighbors. Like it's like, that's not going to make a good shot. Like if you want to get a good camera out there, it's not worth it unless there's 20 or 30 people buried there. Which is a weird place to get to.
The idea that there's this whole cottage industry around war itself is bananas. Like, that is the worst. To hear that man still figures out a way to function at a profit, even in the worst of situations, because we have to. That's awful.
Yeah, because all the jobs disappeared. Sengar has a kid and a wife, and there's no all of the oil jobs left when the war came. So, like, he just started doing this. And so, like, on one hand, it's like horrible to hear somebody talk about like, yeah, it's only one person died in that airstrike, so it's not worth filming.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, it's like, well, but he knows what he's talking about. Like, he knows it's not going to make a good shot, and it's his job to get good shots. And the better footage I get, the more jobs he gets, so he gets to continue to support his family.
Do we know what happens to these people in terms of, like, after everything gets calm, are they able to assume positions of power because they have withstood and actually made friends during this time?
I think a lot of people are going to be just shit out of luck and out of work. I think Sengar is going to do okay because he's probably the best fixer working out there.
Grimy.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing. Yeah. He'll talk a little bit later about his plans for the future, but he could be a politician easily. Like, he's one of those people who just knows everybody out there.
If democracy occurs.
Kind of either or.
Okay.
So I was curious as to whether or not he has a hard time like commodifying human life this way, like talking about it like it's a like it's a commodity. I don't know. I
sort of talking about it like it's a stock where you go, where you go, today's not a good day to invest in that sort of maneuver. But over here, we've got 48 bodies. So it's a good prospect, maybe something we should pay attention to.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to describe it. So here he is kind of walking us through his thought process there.
You know, like difficult when you see babies, like when you when you're old, they are so small and they dead, you know, and you put them in the blue bag. And sometimes when the sister or the mother, they only left and the others all under the rubble. So those like, yeah, it hurts me, but it's something like I got used to, you know, because everyone, especially in East now, every family, they lost members of the family, you know, son, children.
He sounds super callous when he talks about bodies that way, but at the same time, it's not like a psychopathic thing that's going on here. It's just that when you've grown up in a place where violence is this common, like you said, everybody, every family he knows has lost somebody. And when you live in that kind of place, it just, you talk about violence like it's the weather.
And imagine that distance and PTSD go hand in hand, and that the way to get through those situations is to actually pull back and sort of talk about it in a very clinical way.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, yeah, no, there's a bombing there this morning. You know, we probably shouldn't drive through there just because the streets are going to be all fucked up. Like it's a rainstorm that hits or something.
And your response was, oh, man, I really wanted a bagel this morning.
Yeah.
But the way that you're talking about it is, oh, I really wanted a bagel this morning. We can't get it. Why? The bridge has been bombed. Oh, man, those bagels are so good.
Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it. It's weird when you get to like know people in Iraq on like a personal level, because every one of them has like, it's the only place I've been where every single person has seen someone get killed, like with their own eyes. Like every person you meet on the street, every little kid, every adult, like they've seen at least one person get shot or blown up. Like that's just like a universal experience. It's like
You've never been to Chicago?
Yeah. It is a lot. Like, that's why they call it Chirac, right?
Yeah. Right.
It is weird talking to people in Iraq about Chicago, because they're all like, I hear Chicago's as bad as it is here. And I'm like, not really, man.
Like, the train still runs. It's just a 4x4x block neighborhood. It's not the whole region.
Yeah. There's a difference between like, yeah, people get shot a lot and yeah, cars blow up all the time.
But can you drive away from the danger and drama in the Middle East?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a lot of like where these guys live. These guys live in Erbil, and they're all, the war is in Mosul, which is about an hour and a half away.
Okay.
So Mosul looks like Stalingrad. Like it's just bombed to shit. The fighting's over now, but at that point it was still very active. And Erbil is like a nice city. I'd say it's no more dangerous than Los Angeles.
And that's the thing, is I don't think people have a concept of the space we're talking about.
Yeah.
People don't usually get the square footage or the square miles of where the fighting is, where it's safe to be. I think most Americans think the entire Middle East is fighting.
Yeah.
But that's not true.
No, there's just islands of shit and islands of sanity. And they're all islands. So, like, it's one of those things where you got to be careful about where you're going, because from one city to the next, the level of safety is very different. But in the safe places, like, you walk around the street, you get drunk and stagger home at night, like, you're fine.
So it's like Chinese food in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Some places could be explosive.
Yes.
But most places are all right.
I don't know that I'd say most. Okay, so here's IR talking about like what it's like growing up as a little kid in this part of the world, like the kind of shit that you just see by the time you're like 15 years old, just as a matter of course.
You know, like because I grew up in Kirkuk, I told you like we kind of get used to it, because I was there at the time when the American army was fighting with Al Qaeda, so there was always fight in our neighborhood. Like many people got killed in my street, like, you know. So we kind of, we'll get used to it, of the sound and, you know, the explosions. I mean, they used to blow up cars in our city, so in the morning, like every week, you could hear like 3-4 cars exploding, so you kind of get used to it. You don't get shocked, you know.
It's a little worse than Chicago. I don't want to underestimate how dangerous the job can be. Like, they don't get shocked. I've never seen either of these guys panic in, like, situations where I was like, ooh, boy, might have gotten it over my head here. It's crazy how much they get shot at, which is one of the weird, like, if you're a journalist out there, you've got health insurance, probably, unless you're a freelancer. And one of the things that's really messed up is there's no health insurance for, like, the fixers. Like, they're just kind of completely on their own because they're independent contractors to the nth degree.
South of Hamdaniya, we were covering a village, you know. We're taking a village, then they came out from behind us, you know. some guys in the motorbike and stuff, they start shooting us. And IR was in the base, you know, IR and the driver. They hear that we got ambushed from the soldiers, you know. And IR knew it's about us, and he was calling me, I didn't pick up the phone. And then I told him, like, yes, we got ambushed and they are shooting us, but now the tanks are coming back. And we could see them, like they are coming towards us. Another time, we're like, you walk and then they shoot behind you, the wall, you know? And you don't know, like, you see your body, oh, no blood, thanks God.
The story he's telling about there with those guys on motorbikes, he was out with the BBC in this town called Hamdania, and they got ambushed by a bunch of guys with machine guns on motorcycles who were just rolling around firing. Like, it was a Mad Max situation. Like, that's what this guy's doing 2 days before taking, like, a math final. Is getting like shot at by motorcycle riding guys and rescued by like tanks and helicopters. Like it's like moonlighting in the Mad Max world. And then you got to go back and do school too.
And your report is about almost dying.
Almost dying. Yeah. Also, I made a great Hamdania joke. It's this little bitty town, and there's this really fat army guy that we didn't like because he didn't want us to go places, and my fixers didn't like him. They were always talking about how fat he was because, like, clearly you're not out there fighting because look at you. And I was like, I guess that guy must be from Hamdania.
That's hilarious.
Nobody laughed at the time, but I was really proud of it.
I don't think they eat ham. They don't touch pork.
Yeah,
so they were like, we don't get it. Yeah. And they're like, well, where we come from, ham is something that fat people love.
Yeah.
So Hamdania. He looks like two Sam Danias were in his Hamdania. Yeah. Who ate all the ham? Damn ya!
That's what our listeners come back to for every week, is dad jokes about war. Yeah. All right, so that's a Sengar story about almost getting killed. Here's IR. Here's actually his response the first time I asked him if he'd ever been shot at.
It was with Peshmerga, like Peshmerga fighting ISIS.
Mm-hmm. That was in north, right?
Yeah, so I was just behind, you know, the Peshmerga front line. They were just shooting, and you can hear bullets coming toward us.
How would you describe the sound of a bullet coming towards you?
Like a mosquito going through, you know, next to your ears.
I think I got shot at for the first time about 4 hours after that conversation. And he's like, yeah, that's like a mosquito going past your ears is kind of right.
By the time you hear it, it's too close.
Yeah, yeah. Like the ones that you are aware of aren't the problems.
Yeah.
The ones that just like zings past and you're like, oh my God. I do want to tell my favorite story about IR because I think it, Sengar's kind of like a daredevil. Like, he likes getting out there and getting into the thick of it. IR is probably the most careful person I know. And another journalist I was working with told me a story about how when they were, the east side of the city was first taken, they were working there talking to people who'd just gotten freed. And this restaurant had just opened up. It was one of the first restaurants in town to open up after, like, ISIS got kicked out of that chunk of town. And it looked good, so the journalist was like, hey, let's grab a bite to eat there. And IR's exact statement was something along the lines of, if I was a terrorist, that's exactly the kind of place I would blow up. And so they didn't eat there. And 2 days later, ISIS blew up the restaurant and killed 30 people. And that's a part of his job, too, is being able to, like, think like a terrorist. So we tried to record this, and there was a bunch of ambulances running by because it was a war zone and there's a lot of ambulances out there. So the audio didn't take super well, but this is basically the speech that he gave, like, right before we got out to the front line, which is kind of his, like, stock speech to journalists. And it's, he basically just, like, looks you right in the eyes and says, if you don't need this story, if it's not important, let's not do it. I always tell people this because, you know, sometimes you get horror stories and people get killed. And, I mean, you can always get some action in less dangerous places. So if you don't need it, let's not go. And if we go, stay close to us. If something happens, try to stay calm. Don't run away because you'll get lost because it's a crowded city. You can get lost, you know, in a house here. Like, it's that kind of place. And, like, the third time we went out there, we were just kind of standing around at this checkpoint, and I was pretty relaxed because we were still about a quarter of a mile away from the fighting. And there's this big explosion, and we see this plume of black smoke into the sky, like less than a quarter of a mile away. And then one of the soldiers gets a call on the radio, and they're just like, yeah, a truck full of journalists just got blown up by a vehicle-based IED. And two French journalists were killed, and one fixer was killed. So that was the whole talk of the town that day, is that, like, this group of journalists just gotten blown up, which, you know, is one of those, reiterated his speech to me, like, that's why you don't go anywhere if you don't know you need to be out in the line of fire, because anything can happen. Absolutely anything can happen out there. And it's weird because there's this level of, like, acceptance of that. So there's, like, a big community in any kind of war zone of like volunteer medics who just go out there from all over the world to like help with the casualties. And we met a bunch of them right after that, and they'd worked on the guys who wound up dying, and they were trading around pictures of like these people who just died, and be like, look at what happened to this guy, look at what happened to this guy. And it's just like, that's the kind of culture you get out there. Nobody has a filter anymore because it's been kind of eroded by constant stress and death. Because that would never happen in a normal hospital. People aren't texting themselves like, look at this, look what happened to this fucking guy. But that's how they do it out there, because it's just, I don't know, normalized.
Yeah, the only thing that sounds similar is the way that drugs are happening in sort of Mexico, where their death is a part of the culture at this point, because they're losing 15, 16,000 people a year.
Yeah, that's a good comparison point to make. Because of that level of danger, though, because of how often like journalists were getting killed, the Iraqi army set up basically like a fake section of the front line to tour people to. And it was like kind of like a Disney ride. Like you'd go up there and they would kind of deliberately provoke the snipers. And so a sniper would fire a shot, but it would just hit the berm. And then they'd get to shoot back with everything. And the Iraqis, they love shooting, especially those RPGs. Like I've never seen anybody fire an RPG without a smile on their face. Like it's they love shooting off those big ass rockets. And so a couple of shots of incoming would go, and then they would fire everything they had in just the general direction of that sniper. And the journalists would all get their videos and their photos. And then there was literally a song and dance number where the soldiers would like do this little chant and like dance together. And then you get back on the bus and they drive you away. And so that was like, that was what they do every day in that little section of the line. So you can't get up to the front unless you go take that tour. And then Iron Sangar's job was to lose the tour group so that we could actually get to some places that weren't tame. So like your goal is to get to be part of this convoy and then escape after you do the scheduled tour. And so that was kind of like what you do every day is you go out there and you film the tame part of the front line so that you're pleasing the soldiers, and then you escape and you're just alone in this war zone trying to find people to talk to. And so that was like, that's a big part of their job out there. And I guess you're as safe as the people that you're able to make your friends in that region. And so weirdly enough, one of the most potent weapons Sangar had for keeping us safe and for finding people to talk to and host us was the word Habibi, which literally means my dearest or my darling in Arabic. Every time he gets out of the car and we're meeting a new group of soldiers, he's got his hands on their shoulders. He's calling them his darling. He's like offering them cigarettes. He keeps like energy drinks in the truck. Like like a pickup artist almost.
And it is, it does feel a little bit like a galaxy sort of thing where like in Star Wars, we're like, well, if you go to that planet, you got to take this with you. And,
yeah.
And they love this and we make tons of this, but they don't have any of it. So we drop this off just so you can get from planet to planet to planet.
Yeah. And it's every time you go somewhere, he's either knows people there or he's trying to make them his friends so that he can get more connections, so that he can like make a phone call when he's like, I got to get past this checkpoint. You know, buddy, can you vouch for me? Or he can either talk his way past or he can find us a place to crash for the night. But it's all about like charming them. And that's like what Sangar was really good at, was making people like him, was like basically making friends and then asking those friends for favors. That's like his whole day job. So I asked him to explain particularly the word Habibi and how you like flirt with Arab soldiers in the Middle East.
So close to hey baby.
Yeah, that is basically what it is. It's hey baby.
Habibi means my love. You know, here in Iraq, we use it. So if you have any service, what can I do for you, Habibi? You know, like, you have to use nice words with the soldiers. Actually, they deserve it. Mm-hmm. They deserve nice words. And in that way, they respect you. Also, if you use some unique, for me, I use some unique words, like, you have any service can I do for you? Mm-hmm. How can I serve you? I tell them this because once I come back next time, they think like, oh, this guy told us any service, you know, the guy will remember me. Just like Hussein, you know, the fat guy.
Okay, I got to tell a story about this guy Hussein, this fat guy, because he called himself the Crocodile. That was the name that he introduced himself by. And all day long, while we were waiting at this checkpoint, civilians would drive up in cars and start yelling at him because he wouldn't let them through. And he would shoot at them, but not to hurt them. He would just fire his gun directly next to their head to get them to shut up. And it was like he was such a nice guy the rest of the time. But then he would just start firing at some old lady or some old man who was yelling at him to come past the checkpoint. And eventually I was like, that's really weird to me to watch you do that, man. And he's like, yeah, well, I'm out here 12 hours a day. And every time someone argues with me, I can either yell with them and lose my voice and then not be able to talk to anyone, or I can just shoot at them a couple of times.
It's amazing how language changes. They went from, hey, baby, how can I serve you, to, you should probably listen to what I'm saying. I'm just going to fire this gun.
I'm just going to shoot it right past your head.
People adapt.
It's weird because, like, he would shoot 6 inches away from some old guy's face. And then he'd offer me a cigarette and we'd talk about, because he spoke great English, we'd just, like, talk about bullshit.
I live with them, you know, in the same level. Once I go there, I be soldier just like them. You know, same mentalities, same stuff. Yeah, sharing the ideas. Most of the time you talk about the sport, you know, sport in Iraq. And I don't go close to the politics with most of them.
What is the sport?
Soccer. They fucking love soccer. Soccer's the biggest thing in the world out there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody loves, you know, Lionel Messi?
Yeah.
I would say like a third of the shirts men wear there are Lionel Messi jerseys. He's just like the biggest star in the world that nobody in America really knows about unless you know soccer.
He's Jordan.
Yeah, yeah. He's big. Like, I'd be willing to bet as many ISIS guys are wearing Messi jerseys as non-ISIS guys. Like, they just, everybody loves him over there. Like, he could probably walk from one end of the Middle East to the other naked in a suit or in a suit full of dollar bills and not have a problem. One of the things that complicates this informality is that both Sangar and I are atheists, which is not common in that part of the world. It's getting to be more common. There's more and more non-believers in the Middle East every year, I think in part because shit's so fucked up in a lot of that part of the world. But you can't be open about that to random soldiers on the front line. So again, part of like what complicates that informality is pretending to be Muslim.
Few times you meet someone like you, like an atheist, you know? Mm-hmm. Most of them, they are like so religious, so you have to be religious with them. And sometimes they ask me a question, and we didn't see you praying. And I'm like, I'll be like, oh, I'm trying. I find excuses, you know? But when they talk about religion, I have to be religious with them because I'm a fixer, you know? I cannot, like. But if they are my friends, you know, I spend nights with them. Most of them, they know me.
Yeah, so atheism is part of a pretty new trend in Iraq, and non-belief in general is growing around the Arab world. 5% of Saudi citizens are convinced atheists, which is higher than I would have guessed. And I'm going to quote a really interesting New Republic article here called Invisible Atheists, the Spread of Disbelief in the Arab World. It states, the percentage of people who express some measure of religious doubt is higher in the Arab world, 22%, than in South Asia, 17%, and Latin America, 16%. And that 22% is only an average. The percentage goes up higher in some Arab countries, from 24% in Tunisia to 37% in Lebanon.
It's interesting because there are some things that you see that are awful that make you believe there's no God, and then those exact same things in somebody else's hands make you believe there is a God. So it's interesting to get through all of this war with out faith.
I guess I had assumed when I started reading all this and when I talked to IR for the first time about the fact that he was a non-believer, I just assumed that it had something to do with growing up in a country with a lot of religious violence. That like, oh, he probably just got convinced that religion was bad because all of these religious extremists blew cars up in his neighborhood. And it turns out it had absolutely nothing to do with that. He's just like, yeah, when I was a kid, I read a lot of books about science and the universe, and I just stopped believing in God. And I was like, well, that's exactly what happened to me. Why did I think it would be any different for you just because it's dangerous where you live? I don't know. That was like, I guess that was an example of arrogance on my part or cultural whatever it is, just like assuming that it would be different because it's violent over there.
Yeah.
So I learned a lesson. He did say, though, that like he thinks that all of the terrorists have an impact on that general trend. Like there's a lot of, like here in the US, we've got this chunk of young people who are like trying to go back to very traditional attitudes about what it means to be an American. And when I say traditional, I mean like racist and shitty. And kind of the opposite thing is happening over in Iraq with young people.
You know, the young generation, they're not really connected to our culture because they kind of hate it. So I can say the same thing, like, because you grow up with it and you inhale those negativity, and when you reach a point, you just hate it. You just don't want to be part of it.
Inhale negativity.
Yeah.
It's the greatest way you can say that.
Yeah, that's exactly what comes out of you too. It's mm-hmm. like negativity towards kind of everything that your culture represents, which is, it's weird because when you meet a lot of leftists in that part of the world, like actual straight up Marxists and communists who will share memes that if they were being shared by an American, I would assume they were a right-wing Trump supporter because they're so anti-religious, anti-Islam, anti, like it's just what happens when you grow up. Like it's the same thing with, young people in America. Like, I grew up in Texas, and you get a lot of really nasty anti-Christian stuff from atheists who grew up in Texas because we have a chip on our shoulder about being ruled by Republicans.
And the religious right.
And that sort of particularly the religious right.
What we like to call a punitive God.
Yeah.
Not a loving God.
Not a loving God. And so it's the same. It's the same thing over there. Like, I think it's just, there's always going to be a chunk of people who, if you realize how fucked up it is where you live, you just get angry about whatever it is, like your culture, and you don't see, I guess, some of the positive sides. Because that was my experience over there, was being bowled over by, like, all these wonderful aspects of, like, Arab hospitality and the food, how nice everybody is, how welcoming they are with their homes, how, like, they protect their guests. And people who I met over there were all obsessed with the stuff that they loved about America. And I was like, oh, man, I'm just so pissed off at America right now. But, yeah, it was weird. Like, I guess we all kind of wanted to switch places.
It's also really interesting that you said the customs were there before religion. So me wanting you in my house as a guest supersedes any of my faith, which is dope.
Yeah, it is. And that was something that I ran into with a lot of the atheists I met there, being like, well, we love some of these aspects of our culture. Like, some of this stuff is really nice. And they did a study, I think back in 2013 or 14, on which people in the world are most likely to help a stranger. And it was Iraqis by like the world by a long shot, like willing to help a stranger in need. And they love that part of their culture. And then they're like, but also, honor killing is a thing here, and you can have someone assassinated for $100, and that's garbage, and I don't want to live in a country that does that. It's like, I love how good Americans are at making entertainment, and I love how good we are at big, stupid, beautiful things, at like making just dumb, pretty things.
Or a 6-foot pancake.
Or a 6-foot pancake. Taking my British friends out to a diner and getting 14 pancakes with a cup of coffee. That's the stuff I'm proud of. And then, like, I see, you know, our president shouting about nonsense. And I'm like, oh, God. You want to throw the baby out with the bathwater sometimes. And it's even more difficult in a place that's, like, when so much of your culture for your whole life has, like, been defined by violence to, like, try to pick out the things that are still really beautiful and hold on to those.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is probably like the most irritating day of my career. So I'll set the scene. We're at this waiting area for the press where you sit around until you wait to get an escort up to the front line. And we're sitting around waiting for the Iraqi army guys, and a couple of different teams of journalists show up. And then CBS shows up, and they've got like a whole convoy of armored vehicles, and they're all in body armor. They've got cash coming out of their assholes. And we have a nice conversation with them. One of them's complaining about, like, that, you know, that mosque that got blown up, the Al-Nuri Mosque? It was, like, where the caliphate was declared. It was a big deal in the war. So this is right before it got blown up. And this guy is talking about how his editor really wants an exclusive and wants to be the first team in there. And we're all like, yeah, they're just going to blow that thing up. Nobody's ever going to get inside there, which wound up being right. But he was making all this big point about how it's dumb to focus on exclusives and everybody should just go out and get the best stories they can, because the way the media moves today, none of that matters. Rushing to be the first person someone was dumb. And then the army guys arrive, and this guy walks up to them, and they have a little conversation, and the army guys say they're not taking anyone. And then CBS rolls out with the army guys, and what turns out is that CBS had bribed the army to not let anyone else pass the front line. And it took us like 3 hours to get up to the front at that point, because all of the checkpoints, the army guy that they'd bribed had told no one to let pass and had like passed some of the bribe along so that they wouldn't let other journalists up. And it really pissed off our fixers. And it was also CBS could capture that little 20-minute firefight, that little fake thing that they do every morning. It was also they could be the only ones to film it that day. It was just one of the sleaziest things I've seen out there. And it took, we eventually got further than they are. We got a little escort up to this battlefield that had just been captured. We got to do like a tour of it right after they finished. And we were the only ones who got up there that day. But it was just because my fixers kept at it for like literally 3 or 4 hours of just like waiting in checkpoints, talking to people, calling friends of theirs who were in the army. That's just what they had to do to get us through that day. And so we wound up shooting a VR documentary at the front that day, which was really cool. And I guess fuck CBS because they didn't get up there. That's my I hate CBS, but we got further than you. Sleazy motherfuckers story. So I asked Sangar after all this happened, like, whether or not he was angry at CBS for screwing, because I was really pissed the entire day. We thought we weren't going to get anything that day, and you're just burning money when you're out there. So I thought that they had just basically slammed the door on the little guy, because we weren't from big outlets, and none of the other guys there were from big outlets, just, like, making other people waste money.
Once you take the bribe, man, you can resell it or give it away.
Yeah.
You feel like that's what they did. They took the bribe and then they stalled and then they let you guys through, right?
No, we had to find people who hadn't been bribed. It was a matter of driving around to different checkpoints and making phone calls until we got to somebody who none of the CBS is connected. It was basically a fight between whether or not CBS had better connections than our fixers. And our fixers won out in the end, but it was a near thing. We did eventually get up to like this battlefield that had just been captured, and we got like a really unique, because there were no other journalists that got in that day to that portion of it. And they, like these soldiers who had just captured this land, like walked us through exactly what they'd done and like recreated the whole. And we got that all in like a 360 cam. It was really cool. But I like what he has to say about, you can't get angry at other people because what your goal out there is to make everyone angry at you, is to like piss them off by getting a better story than they can, which is like, that's actually good journalism in a nutshell right there. Like he's got a really good bead on what it takes to be a good journalist. Mm-hmm. So one of the annoying things that you have to do in this job, both as a journalist and as a fixer, is you have to spend a lot of time talking to generals. And nobody wants to. They never have anything good to say. There's never any interesting reason to interview a general because they're all press savvy. They all say the same bullshit, which is like, our soldiers are brave, they're going to win, we made progress, like, it's fine, everything's going well. But one thing they both IR and Sangar stressed to me is how important it is to find characters, people who look interesting and who, and it's usually field officers, majors and captains are the best ones to talk to, but like people who are just fascinating. There's a guy, probably the best character they ever found was for a journalist, was a guy named Major Mezer Sadoun. And he's basically the living embodiment of a Liam Neeson character. So he's this Iraqi SWAT officer who, after his city got taken over by ISIS, formed a SWAT team made entirely of guys who'd had family members killed by ISIS. And so it was all like a revenge quest for this group of guys. He's a big man and he's got crazy eyes. I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones, but there's a character on it, Tormund, he's the big red-headed, bearded guy. And he's got these kind of crazy eyes. And you see them on, the guy who plays the main character in Vikings 2 has eyes like that. And I think they're just both maybe really good at acting like that, but it's the same kind of look that you see. The only way I know how to describe it is it's the way dangerous people look.
Yeah.
It's the way, not necessarily mean or evil people, people who are very comfortable immediately using violence. So I met this guy, Mezer, once, and we had like a long civilized talk, just interviewed him about the war and everything. And then as we were leaving, this captured ISIS guy gets brought in. Mezer just starts kicking the shit out of him. And it was just like in an instant, he was just perfectly comfortable. And he wasn't kicking him because he was an ISIS guy. He was kicking him because the guy was crying. And he was like, you don't fucking cry around me, buddy. That's a big part of their job, is finding people like that, because that's who sells a story to the audience. Like, not in the crude financial sense of getting someone to buy your story, but that's what gets people to read a story.
Casting.
Yeah, it's casting. It is like a big part of their job is like, who looks really intense and wild? Who's going to tell crazy stories about gunfights and stirring speeches and calling the enemy pussies and shooting at your own men just to like get them in line? Like who's going to be doing stuff like that? Those are the guys we need to introduce our reporters to, because those are the guys, as a journalist, you want to talk to. Like, that's what you want in the story. You don't want to listen to the guy at top yammer on about force dispositions. You want to listen to, like, some nut job kick around an ISIS guy and start ranting about how he wants to kill all these motherfuckers. So I talked to IR a little bit about Mezer, just because he's such an intense dude. And I found why he thought that guy was a good character really interesting.
He was amazing because he was also photogenic because of his scars, yeah, and tattoos, and he was looking so tough. Like, let's say in an article, even if you lie about him, people are going to believe it.
Yes. So the value of a good character is twofold, according to IR. One is that foreigners can connect with them more easily, because it's hard to get people to care about anything that happens in Iraq, but it's easy to get people to care with a guy who looks like a Jean-Claude Van Damme character.
Or Dog the Bounty Hunter.
Or Dog the fucking Bounty Hunter. Yeah. So foreigners connect to these people, but it's also that like highlighting these stories inspires Iraqis and makes them feel good about Iraq, and that's really hard actually.
When they have a charismatic commander, that team is fighting better, because in Iraq our culture is like that. We always like want to follow someone. We're not like European countries or the United States. We're not individualistic. Yeah.
But even in the United States, like, we have all these war movies about, you know, Americans who are heroes or whatever, like soldiers who were particularly charismatic, like.
Mm-hmm. But this is how we grow up. I mean, even if you look at the structure of the society, it was always sheikhs and tribe leaders and a father with a four women and big family.
Yeah.
So it was always like this. It's in something inside the culture. When I look at the war in Mosul, those charismatic people, they're achieving more because the people around them, they trust them, and we always try to find someone like them, someone charismatic.
It's interesting to me that they made this guy Mezer famous in Iraq. Like, he's like a national hero now because the New Yorker did this big article called Inside the Desperate Battle to Destroy ISIS, that this guy is like a really big feature, and because he was always rushing like first person into the buildings. He got blown up a whole bunch of times. Face got ripped apart by a car bomb. Like, he's just this like action hero guy who led this vengeance squad. And now he's like a hero to his country. And I think some of that's self-preservation because the country, Iraq's been tearing itself apart for the last 20 years. And I think one of the things that really impresses me about IR is that he recognizes that things are only going to get better if people start building some shared myths about like what it means to be an Iraqi. Like, we have a ton of shared myths about our soldiers and military personnel, and that's kind of what he sees as part of his job. Like, it's not just making money, it's building like a basis of myth for his country that they just haven't had up to this point.
Heroes to rally around.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Iraq is a pretty new country. Like, it's the oldest part of the world. Like, we had to cross the Tigris to get into Mosul, but Iraq hasn't been a country for a very long time, like since the end of World War One, basically.
So the running to be George Washington is high right now.
Yeah, yeah. They really need a George Washington. And that's obvious. That sure as hell isn't Saddam Hussein. So that's kind of what everybody's... Yeah, it's interesting to me that they're in that position because we have such a diverse base of myths here. No matter... You've got thousands of people to pick from if you want to find people who have been lionized in American history, whether you're going to
be... You could be Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
You could be George Washington, you could be Andrew Carnegie.
Yeah.
All three different, but all three heroes.
And, you know, there's Wyatt Earp, and there's all these, you know, Sergeant York and Andy Kaufman. Like, we've got this really wide base of people that you can idolize in America that all represent something about our culture. And I don't think we think enough about how important that is. Like, that keeps us together as a country as much as the IRS and the police and...
Peanut butter.
And peanut butter. Well, peanut, and more important than peanut butter, is kind of the myth of the man, George Washington Carter. There's another fucking hero for you.
Carver.
Huh?
Carver.
Did I say Carter?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, there we go.
But the president, you merged the two, George Washington Carver and President Carter, both peanut icons.
Building homes for the poor out of peanut butter and the bones of bankers. Yeah, so there's an element of what these guys are doing that are basically propaganda. And I asked IR pretty straight up, like, if he saw himself as a propagandist, and he didn't really deny that. Like, he felt that was fair.
Do you think there's an element of what you're doing that's propaganda?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we show them what's happening in here. Yeah, we show them, like, people suffering and families are starving. I mean, when people eat at McDonald's, they should also know that someone is suffering and starving in here. I mean, all this food is going to waste, and, you know, people don't care about, you know, that they don't care about poverty, they don't care about, you know, they're just being selfish. So maybe with these stories we can tell them what's happening.
Like Hollywood, basically.
Yeah, it is. It is exactly that.
But, the idea that we'll shoot a movie about rape before we'll shoot a movie against rape. We'll show a movie about slavery before we will show a movie about racial healing.
I didn't think about that. But I guess, how do you dramatize that, too? Because, I don't know, Crash, I guess. That was like the basic idea, right?
And I think, this guy is based, you know, not to reiterate it, but I think the guy is basically saying, look, nobody'd be talking about it, so even propaganda is useful in this condition.
Yeah. I don't know. I think he might. I don't think he reads much Orwell, but I think he might agree with the old Orwell quote that all art is propaganda. That, like, you're trying to get people to feel something. And I think that's probably an important thing to accept. Like, journalism is inherently propaganda because if you care about what you're doing as a journalist, you are trying to get people to feel something. So one of the things that was really tough about their job, about fixing, is the stuff that's more really clearly propaganda. And this is the stuff that I have some difficulty too, because there's a lot of little rules out there about what you can say to who and what you can ask and what you can film. You can't ask the military guys about civilian casualties. If you want to talk about civilians who are getting killed, you go talk to the people who clean up civilian bodies, and they'll talk to you about all the civilians who get killed in the airstrikes, but the soldiers won't do that. And if you want to ask the army guys that, they're just going to clam up. They won't say anything. And another big no is that you can't take pictures or videos of wounded soldiers. We actually got up to a field hospital where a bunch of shot guys had just gotten pulled into, and they were like trying to staunch bleeding wounds and like literally hosing the blood off of the ground with like a garden hose because there was so much of it. And it would have made, and again, you sound like a monster talking about this, it would have made an incredible shot. But you just can't film that stuff. And here's Sengar explaining like why that's such a strict rule.
If you record those wounded soldiers, the enemy will take advantage from that. Like, immediately they post it in social media and everything. But, and they tell us, like, at the end, once the enemy finished, he will give you the statistic data, you know, like the number, how many soldiers got killed and how many wounded. But not now in the fighting time.
So, yeah, as soon as you put up a video of a soldier who's gotten killed, ISIS is going to throw that shit on Twitter in like minutes, or Facebook. Like that, it's weird that that's a dimension of it to me.
High school.
Yeah, yeah. And he was also like, there's really no point in them hiding it because the soldier's friends also will be posting on Facebook about their buddy who just got killed. Like everybody's on Facebook all the time out there. Like anytime they're not getting shot at, the soldiers have their phones out and they're checking Facebook. It's the weirdest, I guess, dimension of this war is that like, everybody's posting on social media about their fighting as they're doing it. We've talked a lot about how much compartmentalization is necessary to do this job and about how you have to, or how IR and Sengar have to like kind of commodify death and human suffering to an extent. And I don't want that to overwhelm how, I don't know, the amount of compassion that I also saw these guys see. Like it's this is a very personal war to both of them, especially IR.
I lost two cousins in Kirkuk. They got killed by Al-Qaeda.
And when was this?
2005.
And how old would you have been back then?
15.
Can you tell me about that?
Actually, that was scary because they got hit by a suicide car. Mm-hmm. So it was all ripped off and shrapnels everywhere. Yeah, that was scary. But I think that's why when we see dead bodies in this world, we kind of get used to it. We don't get affected that much. Because I lost two of my cousins. One of them got killed in 2015, and the other one got killed in 2005. He was in Peshmerga. He went inside the house, he opened the door, and it was a booby trap. Yeah, so he opened the door and the gut exploded.
And about the only time I ever saw him like really get emotional, because you can hear he's got kind of that shallow affect in his voice, is when we would meet little kids who had just gotten freed from like the ISIS areas and who usually had just gotten their homes blown up. And that's because when he was a little kid, he was a refugee.
91, because my father was Kurdish and they kicked us out from Kirkuk, the Baas regime, the Saddam Hussein's government. So my family went to Iran. They stayed in refugee camps there. And in 94, they came back to Erbil. And they stayed in Erbil until 97. And because of the political issues, we had to leave and we went to Turkey.
Yeah, and he's like, he was marching through the woods with his family and like hiking through the desert. And he didn't really have many toys, but like all he took, I asked him what he took with him as a little kid fleeing his home, and he's like a hammer and a screwdriver so that he could build his own toys wherever he got. And so he would build out of like spare bits of wood, like construction equipment toys, like bulldozers and stuff. He would just like screw and hammer them together because there was always dirt wherever he was. So if he built fake construction equipment, then he could play construction. And that was this guy's like whole childhood. He's one of the most resilient people I've ever met, but he was also really clearly hurt by a lot of the stuff that he's seen, like this.
My young girl got shot from her head. Her family was crying, and it was it was one of the terrible scenes I've seen. And I again, after a few minutes, like around 30 to 40 minutes, another soldier arrived. He got killed, like half of his head gone, and his friend were crying.
I'm no doctor, but he definitely reported to me a lot of things that seemed like very clear symptoms of PTSD during our conversations. Nightmares and panic attacks, and there's a time when he would just be drinking every night in order to get to sleep. And I think that stuff is endemic among fixers. Everyone we met who did his job seemed like they were kind of in the same boat. And I also think it's really common for the whole population of people covering the Iraqi Civil War. I went to a party on my third trip out there that was, it was an even mix of journalists, fixers, aid workers, the UN, and spies. Like, it was one of those things where everybody would be like, be careful what you're talking about. There's always spies at these parties. Like, the UN almost got the party shut down because they parked their car in, like, one of the neighbor's parking spots, and we had to find the UN guys who were really drunk to get them to move their Land Rover.
Or it's going to be an international incident.
Yeah. Well, this, the cops would bust the party. But the drinking there is astonishing. Every journalist and every fixer that I've met, almost all of them drank heavily. It was, and I, if you go to any of the bars that are expat bars or bars that cater to foreigners in Iraq, you will see people drinking like I have not seen anywhere in the world. And I've spent a lot of time in Ireland, a lot of time in the UK, a lot of time in Germany, a lot of time in the Baltic states. Like, I've been to a lot of places where they have very big drinking cultures. I've never seen drinking like journalists and fixers, just like apocalyptic.
Again, shout out to Chicago. There's a bar in every corner and puke on every sidewalk.
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of that. It doesn't help that they sell whiskey in 12-ounce cans for a dollar out there. It was one of the drunkest places I've ever been. And it was, I think a lot of it was clearly coping. It's because a lot of the journalists who are there long-term are freelancers, so they don't have mental health care. And in Iraq, there's no such thing as therapists. Like, that was, we tried to talk to Iyer about the concept of a therapist, and he was like, I guess I've heard that that's a job, but we don't really have that here. You just kind of deal with it. So it seems like there's a lot of people who are going to have untreated problems in the wake of this war with ISIS that are just going to just stay underneath the surface for a while. And I don't know how they're ever going to deal with it. But then on the other side of that, you've got people like Sangar, who claims to be pretty much unaffected by everything that he's seen out there. And it might be true, to be honest. I think some people are just built for war.
No, like most of my relatives and cousins, when they see my footage or my videos and stuff and the places I go, they tell me, we swear, like, you cannot sleep at night. You know, I know, like, no, I even don't dream. They don't come to my... But the only thing is the smell, you know?
Yeah.
When the smell of the bodies. Mm. The guy, the ISIS fighter we saw,
yeah,
didn't have, like, smell, but the others, when you go with civil defense, you come back, like, you cannot eat for 2 or 3 hours because you still like the smell in your brain, but after that, like, I'll be fine again.
So that's what he says, and I don't think he's entirely fooling himself, but it's also was really clear to me just from talking to him that this has had an impact on his family life. Sangar has a wife and a year-and-a-half-old daughter, and his wife is really not happy that her husband's job involves him getting shot at every day.
Yeah, she tells me, like, find another suitable job with a good salary or even not good salary, like, better than this front line and this bullet stuff. You get bullet in your car now, next time it will be on you. Or everyone from Mosul now, they know you're working with foreigners. In the future, they're gonna kill you. Yeah, and I'm telling you, like, nobody knows me. I'm changing my name there and blah, blah. But they know you because, yeah, I'm in the front line, you know? I'm in front, like, I'm before all news agencies, mm-hmm, with my journals, right? So when I post some stuff there, they steal from my account and they post it, so, and they mention my name. And my wife tells me, look, everyone mentions your name and everyone can open your Facebook account and they know you at that time. And I have to find another way to convince her.
Does it make it harder, do you think, the fact that you have a young kid?
Yes, it is. In a way, when you stay like for 5 days in the field or when you're on a documentary report or... Yeah, and you stay more than a week. Yeah, I miss her. But once I come back, yeah, we'll be fine, like after 1 hour. And then we start fighting. Because she annoys me. Yeah, and she wants to be with me the whole time. Yeah, and I'm, get away. I need to sleep, you know. I just took a shower, I want to sleep. And she comes again. She moves me. Oh, get up. You sleep with me or you go. Yeah, and she comes, I play like some cartoon, and she sleeps with me.
So that's his life.
I think even Michelle Obama was like, you need to find another job. They're using your name. You're dealing with all these foreigners.
This is getting sketchy.
It's getting sketchy.
Yeah. Look at your hair.
Right.
You've clearly aged 15 years.
Right.
So as we record this podcast, the fighting in Mosul is freshly over. There's still some more fighting to be done in northern Iraq, and Sangar at least intends to keep fixing until the war is completely over. And he might go to Syria after that point. He really likes the work.
Is it all because the money's good, or is it all...
It used to be all about money, you know?
Yeah.
But now it's all about connections and helping families, especially, you know, if you're focusing, I was talking to almost all families there. Those who were escaping like 2 days ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was telling them the processes, how they go, yeah, you have a wounded, someone wounded in your, yeah, take him to that hospital, to that field hospital, and then they take you to the other hospital, and then you know the process. And yeah, this area is liberated. If you walk like 3 minutes or five minutes or 10 minutes, you will be with lots of people, life is back there. So I'll make them more calm, you know, and I help them in that way. And connection is, for me, connection is good for, like, after when Mosul is done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have all those connections if I need anything from, yeah, maybe tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, I candidate myself for a political field or political department, you know.
Oh, you think you might go into politics?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe I switch to politics.
Because being a fixer wasn't dangerous enough.
Yeah.
I think I'll actually become a politician in the Middle East.
I'll really make myself a target there.
Oh, man. I imagine that that's what could happen, is that if you are the victor or if you are still living and you figured out a way to carve out a life, then yeah, you do get the spoils.
Yeah, and the spoils in this case are all the people you know now. Like, he's got connections across the whole country. I think he probably could go into politics successfully. Whether or not he'd stay alive in that job is another thing entirely.
Also, a true manifestation of power is not to feed yourself. It's to feed the people around you. It's very easy to get yourself fed. But if you can actually then parlay that into hooking other people up, then that's how you know you've actually got some power. And it sounds like that's where his brain is as well, when he was saying, I want to help these families.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think he also, I think, again, he's just sort of built for excitement and activity. Whereas Ayar is more of a thinker and a planner, and I think he's done with this shit. We went with him on his last trip out as a fixer, and when we got back, he mentioned a few times how worried he was that Sangar was never going to quit, that he was just going to move to Syria and work on that war and get hurt or killed. And Ayar seemed really happy that he was done with the job, and he said that repeatedly. But then on his first night after quitting, he drove us out to this house where a bunch of expat medics called the Free Burma Rangers lived, and we met up with one of them who'd managed to steal an ISIS laptop from one of their command centers and wanted to try to sell the data. So Ayar checked the laptop out to see if any of the data was usable, and then we watched him broker a deal with a friend of his for an old ISIS license plate that a journalist wanted, and then later that night, the news came out that that mosque, the Al Nuri Mosque, had been blown up, and within a day, he was meeting up with a Kurdish soldier who just had a bunch of drone footage in a briefcase that Ayar sold to the BBC, I think. So even though he's not getting shot at, like, he's got all these connections in journalism. Like, he's still doing that work. He's still making connections. I think it's like, it's almost like an addiction, even if you're not going out into the danger. Like, once you know how to do that kind of work, you just do it because I think it is a little bit addicting.
Yeah. You're no longer a rapper, but you're a crazy producer.
Yeah. I guess that's kind of where things are right now, as of at least a few weeks ago when I was in country last. You know, I wish both of them the best, because they're all really good guys. And I remember bringing up when we were on that one Harmontown episode that one of the quotes from Rick and Morty that really stuck with Ayar was that nobody belongs anywhere, nobody exists on purpose, everybody's going to die. And I think that takes on a more nihilistic cant when you're talking about an American audience. But I don't think he identified with it out of nihilism. I think he identified with it out of, like, practicality, because he lives in a place that's so chaotic and that things explode so regularly and people just die sometimes. And I think when you live in that place, kind of admitting your lack of control is liberating as opposed to nihilistic.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. The good news is you're going to die.
Yeah.
And the bad news is you're going to die.
But either way, at least, like, it's not even worth worrying about, because whatever happens is going to be out of your control.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's our podcast.
Listen, if you're sick and tired of Mondays, the good news is you're going to die.
Yeah. There will be no more Mondays.
There will be no more
point.
Mondays.
Yeah.
And if you love Fridays, the bad news is you're going to die.
Yeah.
But you won't make it to Monday.
Yeah.
Please kill me Sunday night.
That would be, that's everyone's dream. Yeah. That's the American dream, is dying on a Sunday night.
That's right.
So this is the end of the season, but if you listen to all these podcasts,
what?
Oh yeah, yeah, Brandon, you're going to have to find, find something else to do, new parking space.
I got
to
be a fixer.
So if you listen to these podcasts, Cracked Gets Personal this season, and we're like, what a bunch of sissies. I got a story I fight bears for a living, and one of the bears I married, and it's only recognized in 3 countries, but our love is true. Or you have another story. I don't know. Maybe you did something that wasn't marrying a bear after fighting it. I don't know your life. But if you have an interesting story that you want to tell us, you can send us an email to tips@cracked.com. And if we think it's interesting, maybe you could wind up on the next podcast we do where we talk to people.
Don't be so shy that you fuck up and not become famous.
That's exactly right. And also, if you have married a bear, email us immediately.
Cracked Gets Personal has been produced by Robert Evans, Brett Rader, and Alex Schmidt. It was engineered and edited by Brett Rader. For Robert Evans, I'm your host, Brandon Johnson. Thank you for listening.
Like Fear Wolf. Get ready to quake in your headphones because Earwolf's movie podcasts are talking about horror movies the entire month of October. Listen to How Did This Get Made? The Canon and Cracked Movie Club dissect spine tingling horror classics all month long. And watch out for special spooktacular episodes of Gilbert Gottfried's amazing colossal podcast, The Cracked Podcast. And who charted? Or should I say, Boo Charted? Subscribe to all these shows and follow along on social media with the hashtag FearWolf. And beware of podcasts that go bump in the night!
This has been an Earwolf production. Executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.